WQCS, Fort Pierce, Florida. This is Pioneer Radio, a student-centered program bringing you the voices of Indian River State College from the campus to the community. A local rabbi, a Zen Buddhist, and a Baha'i student walk into a radio station and... This is no joke. This is the next hour of Pioneer Radio. For this episode, we have three stories from religious and spiritual backgrounds. Stories of individuals finding themselves away from their homes and families, stories of receiving help and kindness from complete strangers, and stories of lifelong lessons and practices that can guide us when we may feel lost. Each piece will be introduced by students J.M. Vega, John Raymond Arriaga, and Chelsea Mayo from Dr. Brooks's Writing for Mass Communication course here at IRSC. I'm Joe Phelps, and this is Pioneer Radio.
Greetings. My name is John Raymond Arriaga. Our first piece is brought to you by Heather Hunt Gonzalez. Heather is a fourth-year engineering student at IRSC. In her interview, she sits down with Cantor Bruce Benson, who was the head rabbi at Temple Beth El Israel Synagogue in Port St. Lucie, Florida. Rabbi Benson gives his thoughts on goodness and human nature through anecdotal and traditional Jewish stories.
What makes a good Jew? And what is a mensch?
Ooh. A mensch is a good soul and a good spirit. Somebody who does things because they're the right thing to do. A mensch is somebody who sees reality in a different way and just goes, okay, I was in a Walmart one night, late at night, old woman standing, staring at one of the piles of shelves, and she was talking to herself, and what she was saying was, corn, corn. She just kept repeating it, and she was just standing there. Well, most people just avoided her, including the staff, because everybody assumed that she was a little off. First, it didn't make any sense. She was way too old to have been out at that time of night because she clearly wasn't going to drive. This was a very elderly woman. And she just stood there staring at the shelf saying, corn. To see the world through Jewish eyes and be a mensch is to walk past that woman and to ask her if you can help. And she said, corn. And with that, she pointed to the top shelf where I saw the corn that she couldn't reach. She had been there for 20 minutes. Nobody wanted to talk to her. A mensch is somebody who looks out for the world around them. And I only tell that story because it so specifically clarifies what a mensch does. And you become a mensch not when you do that once, but when you do that every day. When you look for ways to help. When who you are is somebody just good. Goodness is being a mensch. And what was the other half of that? What makes a good Jew?
Yeah.
What makes a good Jew is being a mensch.
What does Judaism teach about human nature? Are we naturally inclined towards good, evil? Are we born into sin?
I know people that are just naturally inclined towards evil. But, no, we don't believe in original sin. We believe that you are born into a world and you make your shame tov. You make your good name or choose not to by your own design and really your own choices. So we don't believe that you carry sin into the start. We have enough issues to deal with without starting out as sinners. We can evolve into that, but that's a choice that we make, sort of like the opposite of a sinner is a mensch. You have to choose to become a mensch. You can't just sit there and go, I am. The Jews tell a story about why does the world continue to exist? The equilibrium is there because of what's known as the 36, the Lamed Vavniks, the two letters Lamed and Vav. In gematria, in letters and numbers, come out to 36. 18 is our mystical number for life. 36 is double. And the belief is that there are 36 people on the earth for whom the earth's equilibrium is balanced. And if we lose them, then all of humankind goes down with it. The question is, how do you know if you are righteous enough to be a Lamed Vavnik? But the answer is simple. If you think you might be one, you're not holy enough to be one. So if you have the audacity or the hubris to think that you could be holy and spiritual and amazing enough to be one of them for whom the earth stands, you've already defiled the concept that it would take to be one. Now, could Mother Teresa have been one of them? Probably so, because we all believe that she never really thought of herself as so self-righteous and so advanced in terms of her life's choices, her ethical choices. So she could have been one of them, but then there's still 35 more. And so we are very wrapped up in how you behave. You take responsibility for yourself. On the high holy days, Rosh Hashanah, New Year's, and Yom Kippur, the Day of Atonement, there are 10 days in between, and you're required to go to anyone to whom you have sinned and ask for their forgiveness. But that's not enough for us. For the Jews, you also have to attempt to bring together everybody who was there at the time and say, I know that what I said wasn't true. The problem with that, to add another layer, is that the lie has already taken on its own life. And so we tell the story of, you know, so this man comes to his rabbi and he says, my God, I told a lie and I don't know what to do with it. How can I repent for this? And the rabbi told him to take his best feather pillow and go to the top of the hill. And he did. And the rabbi then said to him, now tear the pillow open. And he did. The rabbi said, now shake out all the feathers. And they flew all over the mountain and the valley, the hill and the valley. And the rabbi then said to him, now collect all of them. He said, it's impossible, I can't. And the rabbi said, and so it is with your words. Once they're out, there's no getting them back. So you learn to try and watch what you say beforehand, because afterhand doesn't help you. And so we try and do that. That's who we try to be. That's an attempt.
What do you you wish more people understood about the Jewish tradition?
The strength of what we perceive to be the Jewish tradition, which is family. There is a closeness of family that is really quite strong, and that we, in fact, are not the enemy. You know, on one hand, culture talks about the Judeo-Christian ethic, but then you have portions of the culture that are trying to split the Judeo and the Christian in half. Well, it's what Al Gore called an inconvenient truth, that we really are far more together than we are separated. And my concern is that when people look at the Jews and Jewish tradition, there's a tendency to listen to the separators as opposed to those who say, why are we not more togetherers? Why are we not gathering together? Why is everybody sort of postulating their own piece of the puzzle? Where do they think that we are stronger separate? We've never been stronger separate. And so I wish that people would sit down and say, where are the areas where we can come together? I wish we could evolve a sense of win-win. And part of that thing about being a mensch is to create a win-win. You don't have to push somebody else down for you to stand up. And if you do, you don't get it. And I wish people understood. The Jews can be great friends and great support to people if we just talk to each other. We don't have to agree on everything, and we won't. But if we did, how boring would this world be?
You're listening to Pioneer Radio. To learn more about Rabbi Benson and Temple Beth El Israel, please visit their website, templebethelisrael.org.
Our next story takes place during the 1979 Islamic Revolution of Iran. Peaceful demonstrations protesting corrupt government quickly lead to a violent overthrow of the Shah monarchy by Shia Islamists. Born was the Islamic Republic of Iran. Here we meet Parisa. Parisa Irfani is an IRSC student currently studying business administration. Parisa has an inspiring, bittersweet story of her immigration from Persia as a teenage girl. Parisa sat down with Pioneer Radio's Joe Phelps to share her extraordinary story of the changes she witnessed of her homeland before leaving her entire family behind.
Okay. My name is Parisa Irfani. I've been in Vero Beach, Florida since 2010. I live in Maryland since 87 till 2010 when I got remarried and moved to Florida. I'm going to school for business administrative. I worked in finance for 20-some years. So I figured I'd get the degree to go with what I've been doing all these years. I was 10 years old when the government changed. So I could sense the changes, not knowing what's going on, what's happening, because I was in elementary school. So I could sense that a few years before that, because the teachers all of a sudden would come and distinguish the difference between, like before that, we were all students, but then it was like more fanatic Muslims and more other religion. Like I remember in third grade teacher, they would, like, we one subject would be Quran, and it was mandatory, so it didn't, like, so, and we all went through that subject. And I remember being a good student, I always got good grades, so the teacher said, you know, you have to memorize this. I was the first one to memorize it. Then somehow my teacher find out that I was a Baha'i and not Muslim, and she didn't believe me, so she, like, brought me in front of all the students, and she said, you're a good student, how could you be a Baha'i? And I'm like, that's a part of me, you know, I was taught to be the best I could, you know. So it started then, and it, you know, again, I had no idea. I guess not many people knew that that's the route the country would take. I was in fifth grade when I was in fourth grade that it started, and fifth grade, half of the school year, we didn't go to school because of all the chaos in the country. So we had, like, the fanatic one, we had people who protested against the government, we had, like shouts, and we had protests in the street, so it was kind of, like, unsafe sometimes to go out. You would hear screaming and killing, gunshots, like, in the middle of the night. So we went all through that. I remember in fifth grade, and again, like, half of the school year, we didn't even attend the school. And the next year, all the curriculum changed. The next year, the whole thing has changed. Where, like, before that, wearing the scarf, like, the woman could go out, like, civilized in U.S. Like, they would wear miniskirts, they would wear sleeveless shirts, and nobody would say anything, or it wasn't any, you know, there wasn't any eyebrows raised. Versus after this change, then it was mandatory for all of women to wear clothes that covered everything. And then before that, like, we had co-ed schools, versus after the government changed, then they separated boys and girls. So we had all boys and all girls schools. There wasn't co-ed in school anymore. When I left Iran or Persia, I was 16 years old. So by then, I've gone through all of these, you know, heartaches, all these fears, all these, as being a Baha'i and being a woman, I had two strike against me. So as a Baha'i, they prosecuted a lot of Baha'is just because of their faith, just because of their belief. So they get killed. They would raid at their home. They would take everything in their home. They would burn their home. So, you know, some of our family got that treatment. So we knew, like, firsthand, we saw in our own family that this is a possibility. Any day they can come to your home or night, in the middle of the night, they can kill you. There was no justice there. There was no equality of humanity. We didn't have human rights, basically. So I've experienced those firsthand. I wasn't married in Iran. I was only 16 when I escaped. So, but my escape was the same way as the actress in
right.
Not Without My Daughter
right.
has escaped. So we paid the smugglers. My dad at the time, and this was in 85, paid 90 or 95,000 in our money back then to the smugglers to smuggle me out. Uh-huh. I lived in capital. I was born and raised in capital of Iran, which is like DC. But we were supposed to go from Tehran to the border city, which was one of the border cities. that the smugglers would meet us. And, you know, we were given instruction. Being 16 and in Iran and in that time of the whole governmental society, women were mostly, and it, still up to this day most are, but women were kind of like property, not, they're part of their male accompanying. So basically my dad would make all the decision for me in Iran. I mean, this was the government or the Muslim way of thinking, not as Baha'is. So my dad, like in Iran, because we were so conservative, my parents were so afraid. I've never gone anywhere by myself, without my family. We always took trips together. We went all on vacation together. I never worked. I mean, I was so young, so I went to school and came home. So I didn't go anywhere. I didn't do anything by myself. So my dad accompanied me in the bus, right, to Zahedan, to that city, so I won't be by myself. And I remember I said proper goodbye to my mom and my sisters, my siblings, you know, my family. But then I couldn't say goodbye to my dad because the smuggler told us, when you get there, don't make a scene. Like, I was supposed to bring just a small bag. It's like I'm going to my aunt or uncle for a visit for a month and come back. So that's what they told me and my dad, not to make a scene, not to make a big deal out of it. You know, you just say wave goodbye and I see you in a month. I really didn't want to leave. Right. It was very scary for me. I lived all of my life there. I had my siblings there. I had my parents there. I've never left the home to go even sleep over anywhere. So all of a sudden to pick up at 16 and leave, it was scary. It was terrifying. It was, and I was going to a country that I didn't know. I've never been. I didn't know the people. I didn't know the language. I didn't know the culture. And I wouldn't have anybody. I wouldn't have any support. So anybody could do anything to me, and there wasn't anybody to rescue me or help me. And I wasn't used to that. I was not used to that.
Listening to Pioneer Radio, and we're going to take a short break. We return with part two of Parisa's story after she leaves her father in Zahedan and is then smuggled out of Iran to Pakistan.
It's the first song I ever wrote about.
Is it? I have no idea.
Well, sometimes I don't know where this dirty road is taking me. Sometimes I can't even see the reason why. I guess I'll keep a gambling, lots of booze and lots of rambling. It's easier than just waiting around to die. Every one time, friends, I had them all. I even had a paw. He beat her with a belt once cause she cried. She told him to take care of me. She headed down to Tennessee. Oh, it's easier than just a waiting around to die. Well, I come age and I found a girl in a Tuscaloosa bar. And she cleaned me out and hit it on the sly. I tried to kill the pain. I bought some booze and hopped a train. Seemed easier than just a waiting around to die. friend said he knew where some easy money was. We robbed a man, and brother, did we fly. They told her to take care of me. They drug me back to Tennessee, and it's 2 long years of waiting around to die.
We continue with part two of Parisa's escape story. Parisa finds herself 1,500 kilometers away from the only place she has ever known, about 930 miles, or the entire coastline of California. The border of Pakistan, where Parisa can be granted asylum and her freedom, is within reach. We catch up with Parisa in Zakhedan, where she meets her smugglers.
They took us to a house and gave us the ground rule, like what you do, what you don't. Here's what will happen if you get captured. You know, just don't worry about your belonging. We bring your belonging, you run. You know, so they gave us do's and don'ts, and they gave us what to expect. And then, yes, we got, there were probably 10 of us. But they were all in the same scenario. Some, there was one girl, and the rest of them were guys. The girl had her brother and her cousin there, but I was the only one girl that I was by myself. So we all got in a jeep and piled up in a jeep, and the jeep went through this unpaved, pebbled road. With no light. They said we cannot have the light, otherwise the authority would see us and then we get captured. There's a big possibility if you get captured, you disappear, you get killed right away. You know, anything could happen to you at that time. So it's best not to get captured. So we went, and I think it was like 4 or 5 hours drive, and then all of a sudden in the middle of the night they said, okay, you need to get out, because the official had broken the bridge that we could pass over, so we had to walk. So in the middle of the night, thank God it was like moonlight so we could see, and we had to walk for like another 3-4 hours. And I remember at time the other girl would get so tired and sit, and we are like, no, you need to get up. So we would we would get her and carry her, you know, not carry her, but, you know, push her through and get up, let's go. So, but there were animal skeleton, there were like camel skeleton or something. And you see as a 16-year-old and you're like, let's go, let's get out of here. Then we got to another car. So they changed cars so they won't be tracked. And then like, I think it was in the middle of it. So it took us like a day or so before they could stop and fed us. So we ate that night. When we were at that house and they were giving us do's and don'ts, and then we didn't eat or drink till 24 hours later. So they gave us tea, was like, oh my God, this is heaven. And they gave us food, and then they took us, they gave us some disguise. So they gave us the customs. So again, because of the male-female relation in Iran, they gave us these all covered dresses, and then we were part of the the drivers.
Right, I understand.
Family or sisters or daughters, and so we couldn't be detected, and we weren't supposed to speak anything. We were supposed to be quiet, and you know, if they talk to us, don't say anything. So, and then now we are in a place that the language changes, because in Iran they have some cities that they have different dialect. So at parts, like it's still in Iran, in Persia, but you have a different language. So you don't understand even. So if we would talk, they would immediately know, you're not from this part. You're not, you don't belong here. So we need to be completely quiet no matter what. No matter what they ask us, stay quiet and don't say nothing. Then the next time, again, it was in the middle of the night, we got to a place, and it was a dark room, and they said, you all go and sleep there, and we come back next day, pick you up. So we had no idea where it is, who it is, you know, so we all okay. So we went there, and we are sleeping there. The next morning, I remember they brought us tea and cookies. The cookies smelled like kerosene. So we couldn't even eat those. And there was no facilities. So, and then the language barrier. So these were hosts, but that they, you know, they had, the smugglers had brought us to these people. I guess they had connection. They had connection with each other. And the hosts didn't speak the same language as we did. So they didn't speak Farsi. And we keep telling them, where is the facility? So we had to finally gesture to them, we need restrooms. So that's all. And they laughed at us, and they pointed to the bushes outside. We're like, So this is like, you know, if somebody tells somebody from US that, you know, they have no idea. It's like, what do you mean there's no facilities? What do you mean there's no restroom? So, yeah. And then I think they came back again at night. They did most of the traveling at night, right, because it's less detective. It, you know, the authorities could not see us. They couldn't detect us. So that's why they did most of their traveling at night. So we went to a city in Pakistan, which was called Kuwait. And in that city, they told us, you're passed over, you're on the border, you're safe now. So they gave us a contact number that when we go there, we contact this person. And normally how they did it, like the smugglers, they would contact the Baha'i community, or somebody would know that we are arriving and we connect. In that particular time, nobody, I guess, report to anybody. So we went, we had no idea, we had nobody. Nobody came to claim us, so we didn't know the language, we didn't know where we are, we didn't know any, you know, nothing. So the contact number that the smugglers gave us, we called them. They knew some English. Some of the guys in our group knew some English, so they communicated. And so we got a room, we went back and forth, we finally went to a call center in Pakistan and got connected with Baha'is. And then we got a member to come and got us over. And we had, like, there were boarding rooms or boarding school for, you know, male and female, that, you know, the Baha'is got us there and then got us situated. And then I had my dad's second cousin or third cousin was in Pakistan, and he had previously told him, look out for my daughter when she comes there. So I went and stayed with him, with them a while, until I got to be roommate with other girls. And
how are you feeling at that moment? Were you a little relieved, or were you, you know, of course you everything you left behind, and but were
you feel lost. Mm-hmm. You feel like you've lost everything. You lost your identity, you lost yourself, you don't know the language, you don't know the people around you, you don't know your surrounding. It's horrible. It's, you don't have, because I didn't have my family with me, I didn't have anybody that were around me. I had nothing to connect to. So it was like they basically took you from your root, uprooted you, and throw you in a garden with the dirt or everything that it's brand new to you, and you have no idea how to deal with or how to accommodate yourself to even learn how to deal with it.
We're We're going to take another short break, and when we return, we conclude Parisa's journey out of Pakistan and into the United States.
I was walking far from home, where the names were not burned along the wall. Saw a building high as heaven, but the door was so small, door was so small. I saw rain clouds, little babies, and a bridge that had tumbled to the ground. I saw sinners making music, and I've dreamt of that sound. I was walking far from home, but I carried your letters all the while. I saw lovers in a window whisper, warn me like time, warn me like time. I saw sickness blooming fruit trees. I saw blood and a bit of it was mine. I saw children in a river.
According to the U.S. Department of Homeland Security, over 100,000 people immigrated to America from Iran during the 1980s, many who share Parisa's plight of leaving their family at a young age for a chance at a better life. Parisa explains what happened to her after arriving at the UN in Pakistan and her first reunion with her family 20 years after her escape.
It takes anything from 6 months to 2 years. It depends. Like, they would check every credential, they would check all the paperwork, they would check all the stories. Everything has to align, and then you get your sponsor, and they check and they make sure they're capable of taking care of you. So my aunt had to send them her bank account and how much can she take care of me? Can she be responsible for me? Is she a good standing community member in California? You know, I'm not going to go to some murderer or somebody who's in jail, and it's not going to do me any good. But in a process of that, I was in Pakistan for two and a half years. In the process of being there, I met one of the guys that he didn't come with me. Like, he wasn't in my group to get out of Iran. He came later on, a few months later after me being in Pakistan already. And we started dating, and I married him. And I ended up going to Maryland. Okay. His uncle was in Maryland, and he was the same way as me. Like, he came as a refugee. He went through the UN, and then his uncle had sent them a sponsorship.
So were you able to get in touch with anybody once you're in?
Yes, once you're there, then I could, because you know the phone number, so I could contact my parents, and then we talk on the phone, and then I was on limited money that my dad had sent me with. So they would make more of the phone calls. So we would talk to people and ask them, can we use your phone? Can we give your phone out? And then, we would communicate that way. And I still have a lot of letters from my siblings and from my mom and dad. And my baby sister was a year and a half when I left Persia. She was still in diaper. She would sleep in, I would bring her to my bed. I would tell her stories. I would give her the last bottle and, put her to sleep. Then I would put her in her crib and then go to bed. So I kind of was like her godmother, if you want to say, or nanny kind of thing. By that time, my mom was done with raising children, so she would allow me to do more, to pick up more of doing stuff with my sister. And I used to take her to parks. I used to come from high school. When I would come, I would buy cheese curls, and she would come and search my book bag every day for the cheese curl to make sure that I got it for her. So for those, like, I remember when I was leaving Iran, I told my mom, I would not take any of my belonging if you just allow me to take my sister, because I was so close. Like, I felt she was kind of like my own child, kind of. When my sister after me came to Turkey, that was 18 years that I haven't seen my family. So I told them, I would help them money-wise for them to all get to Turkey, and then we can all meet. My son was 12 at the time. So, and they never, none of my family had ever met my son at the time. So we made a reunion in Turkey. So yes, I've seen them before they came here, but the Turkey reunion was bittersweet. Mm-hmm. Because you've lost so many years. I love my family, and I still do, and I did. But I felt like a stranger. So, like, my baby sister was a year and a half. When I met her, she was in her 20s. She was 18, 20, 19. She was a young woman. I still had the love for her. I remember her, but she didn't remember me. She said she got so sick. She got stomach pain and stomach problems for a couple of weeks before she left Iran, because she thought she had no idea how I would react to her. She would ask my mom, would Pariso like me? I'm like, are you serious? You're my sister. Of course I would like you. So I think me and my baby sister, we connect very quickly, because at the time she was still young. But with my other siblings, we've lost so many years. So sometimes they don't know my jokes. They don't know my sarcasm. I don't know theirs. So when they say something, I'm like, really? What? And then I realize, so I've lost a lot. And I remember what my mom said when she first met me. And I said the other day, I said, after 18 years or 20 years, when my mom saw me, she said, you're so beautiful. I'm like, really, mom? That's what you can tell me? of all of my accomplishments. But I guess she was speechless too. At one point, you feel like you are the black sheep of the family. You feel like you don't belong to the family anymore, because you've lost so many years. You lost the family ties, you feel. See, that's why I got married so young, because I was so family oriented. And since I didn't have my family, I'm gonna have my own family.
Interested in learning more about the Baha'i faith and their fight against discrimination in regards to education in Iran today, please visit the website at notacrime.me or search for hashtag education is not a crime.
No surprise, I overslept. Put my boots on and climbed out my tent. I didn't see you, assumed you were sleeping. Immediately start a fire cause it's freezing. I can't believe we went camping in the cold. I'm in the wilderness, standing in some snow. A late start, but we can still catch up. You need to wake up, we should eat and then pack up. It's when I noticed your footprints. The snow's fresh and those have been put since. What, you already up making the rounds? So where you at now? You laid back down? The breeze came and it stalled out the flame while I went to your tent and called out your name. You didn't answer, so I opened up the flap. It's just an empty sleeping bag and your backpack. I'm looking at your tracks and you took a couple laps around the campground and hoofed down the path. I figure you'll return, no concern. I'ma hold put and try to make this cold wood burn. The wind is blowing strong, minutes rolling on. It's going on at least a half an hour you've been gone. It ain't right, start the paranoia. I left the campsite to go and search for you. I read the trail your feet made. Each step was deliberately placed.
It looks like you know where it leads, but I see nothing but leafless, frozen trees. About a quarter mile into the course, and another set of tracks.
Over 2.5 million Americans served in the Vietnam War that spanned over a decade. Young men found themselves 10,000 miles away from their homes and families in a foreign land and country, fighting for survival. Dr. James Pattison, an Eastern Religious Studies professor at IRSC, was one of those men. Last year, Dr. Pattison, who holds a PhD in Zen Buddhism, sat down for a conversation with student Kayla Birch on the parallels between Buddhist and Christian teachings. Our final piece will be of Dr. Pattison's account on how he discovered meditation while enlisted in the Vietnam War.
Before I went to Vietnam, I was a hippie. And hippies have a habit of smoking marijuana, obviously. Uh-huh. Or not obviously, but most people know that, I think. So when I got to Vietnam, I had this habit, and I didn't want to stop. In fact, I found marijuana. You know, now they're talking about using marijuana for medicinal purposes, medical mm-hmm. marijuana. It's up for the vote mm-hmm. coming up. And I found it very helpful then dealing with stress. So, of course, Vietnam was very stressful. Mm-hmm. But this was not recognized by the authorities, so we could drink ourselves silly. Mm-hmm. You know, you could get drunk and nobody would care. Mm-hmm. But no marijuana. But I felt like I could use some, so I snuck into town, a nearby town, that we were told was off limits because of enemy presence, suspected enemy presence in the town, and we were to go, not to go there under any circumstances whatsoever. And I will admit that I was psychologically addicted to marijuana at that point, because had I not been, I would not risk my life in order to go buy some.
How old are you at that point?
19, which is a good point. As I've told my students, because I tell them this story in class, I tell them that when you're 19, your brain, the part of your brain that's associated with good judgment, it hasn't clicked in yet. It doesn't really fully click in until you're in your mid-20s, sometimes later. This is what scientists are saying. So that was definitely poor judgment to put my life at risk just to get some marijuana.
So you snuck out at night?
No, it was during the day. I got somebody to do my job and cover for me and hitched a ride on a truck and took extra grenades and ammunition just in case. And then as I was approaching the nearby village where I planned to buy some marijuana, I came across some kids fishing in a lake. And one of them ran up to me and asked me, mostly by pointing and speaking a little bit of English, asked me if I would throw a grenade into the lake.
Throw a grenade into the water?
Yeah, to help them with their fishing problem.
Oh, okay.
And of course, that was a terrible idea, an absurd thing to ask, but I did do it, and sure enough, a bunch of dead fish and stunned fish floated up to the top. Kids ran out, and they were all excited. And then one of the kids' older sister came, saw what had happened, and said, "Oh, thank you very much. Why don't you come home, have some lunch?"
In English, she said that?
No, but she, you know, she said it. Like I say, there. The communication was a mixture of English mixed with, you know, French and Vietnamese and pointing and gesturing.
Wow.
Yeah. So, but she let me know what she was saying. And obviously that's not a very good idea either when you have been told there's enemy presence there possibly, because for all I know, their family was the enemy. Because
yeah.
Sometimes the enemy were, you know, the North Vietnamese were in uniforms, but you're a lot of Viet Cong, they were called. They dressed in like everybody else, you know. So, but I was hungry. And
So it was just this little village.
Yes, just this little village.
Okay.
And so I went with them and had this wonderful lunch of, I remember it well. So, you know, something stick in your mind. It was boiled rice with boiled vegetables on top and blown up fish on top of that. It's quite excellent. And so I'm sitting there talking to them about various things, and about the war mostly, and they're saying, yes, so-and-so was killed yesterday and so-and-so the day before. a lot of people they knew, and family members, and it was a very small hutch, or hooch, they call it.
Marines call it a hooch. On the floor.
Yeah, I was sitting on the floor, and it was a dirt floor, and no running water, and there's about seven of them in there. So living conditions were pretty bad. Plus, they were getting, you know, they were at risk from both sides, of course, not just the communists, but from the Americans. Both sides were killing them. So, I noticed that they seemed pretty happy, you know, pretty happy given the circumstances, much happier than I was. And I just came from, you know, pretty good country situation in, you know, my life. So I asked him at one point, I said, how is it you guys are so calm and joyful even? And that's when they told me about meditation. They explained what meditation was and how to do it. And that really struck me. And so I started practicing it as soon as I got back home, back to my base, whenever I could. And even though I didn't do it that much because the circumstances were difficult, still I'd say that prevented me, from going, you know, crazier. I mean, I still have effects from that, but it prevented me from really going off in a bad direction psychologically, and also saved me physically, because if you're walking down a jungle path, which you do a lot in that situation, and you're so caught up in your thinking about, let's say, when you go home, how wonderful it's going to be to see your old friends and have cold beer and stuff like that. So you're imagining it. It's almost like a hallucination. It's so real. And you don't see that there's a wire with a grenade attached to it across the path, a tripwire, or you don't see the soldier hiding behind the tree, the enemy soldier, then you don't get to go home. So I'd say it saved me. Yeah, meditation saved me.
So what did they teach you about meditation?
I just showed that to a Buddhist group this morning on a blackboard, but we can't use a blackboard here. But basically it was that reality from the Buddhist point of view is this present moment, right now, is reality. And we all... of course, physically, we're always here and now, but psychologically, we leave the present moment constantly. We start thinking about the future and worrying about the future. Well, what if this happens? What if that happens? In other words, anxiety is really thinking about the future or the past, you know, wishing, oh, I wish that hadn't happened. Why did that have to happen? And so on and so forth. So, you know, if a person really observes their mind, they'll see very quickly that they spend very little time in the present moment. It's almost all worrying about the future or regretting the past. And the little time they do spend in the present, much of it is judging and complaining and just negative stuff. So meditation, though, is the practice of bringing the mind, you know, when you notice that you're off into the future thinking about something, you recognize that rather than get lost in it. You recognize it and you bring your attention back to whatever you're doing. I mean, that would be meditation in action. For example, if you're reading a book and you start to think about something else, you bring yourself back to what you're doing. Or if you're even washing the dishes and you start to trip out in your head and worry about stuff, you come back, you focus on that one dish that you're washing. But formal meditation would be where you sit quietly and you just observe your mind, and when you start to think, you recognize it, and you gently, not forcefully, you gently bring yourself back to focusing on something. It could be your breathing. You can even count each breath up to 10 and then back down again. A lot of people do that. That would be the Buddhist thing to do. As a Christian, though, I sometimes focus on Yah on the in-breath and Way on the out-breath. It's another way to do it. Or to say Jesus is Lord or God is love or something like that. Anything, a little thing to bring you back to the present moment doesn't really matter how you get back to the present moment, as I understand it. So that's what they taught me.
Okay. So it's kind of like controlling your thoughts and...
It's controlling in the sense of letting go of. Because usually, you know, a thought comes up and it usually grabs our attention and we go with it, even if it's negative. So it's having a loose attitude, letting the thought come, letting a thought go. It's definitely not about trying really hard not to think or anything like that, or trying to get rid of all thoughts. It's not that. It's just having a very open-handed attitude towards your thoughts and emotions, where they can come and they can go, and you don't worry about it.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
I thought about not telling that story because of the drug thing. No, but I tell it to all my students, so I figure that it's probably out there anyway. Cat's out of the bag anyway. And besides, that's, you know, it's part of the story.
Listening to Pioneer Radio. If you are interested in more of Dr. Pattison's stories and teachings, there is a Buddhist meditation and study group that meets every Saturday at the Unitarian Universalist Church in Vero Beach at 9:30 a.m.
This concludes today's show. This episode was produced by Joe Phelps, Carrie Delcio, Heather Hunt Gonzalez, Kayla Birch, J.M. Vega, Chelsea Mayo, Lauren Campola, Jelena Phillips, Sabrina Rondo, and Dr. Matthew Brooks. We would like to take this time to give a special thank you to our host station, WQCS, and all those who have assisted in producing this show. Thank you for listening in. This has been your host, John Raymond Arriaga, signing off.
Galloping manic to the mouth of the source, and we were swallowing panic in the face of its force. And I am blue.
All those moments will be lost in time, like tears in rain. Time to die.